I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about diets, food. This is going to start a conversation in the days ahead, in the hours ahead. I promise you that this is going to be something. How many of us want to hear this statement? Why butter, meat, and cheese belong in a healthy diet. That is a subhead on the cover of my guest book, The Big Fat Surprise. Nina Tyshols, contributor to The New Yorker, The Economist, Washington Post, The New York Times, and an NPR correspondent, spent almost a decade researching and writing this book, which has rocked important parts of the nutrition and health world in the United States. She says, olive oil as a health drink? No. The danger of saturated fat? No. The Mediterranean diet as the world's healthiest diet because of grains and vegetables? No. And wait until you hear why. She painstakingly went through decades of studies only to find, she says, flimsy research, overblown and wrong-headed conclusions, and the perpetuation of myths and politics driving science and government findings. Some people who've come up with the data that we live by have done it in a well-intentioned way, other people for self-interest. We have been debating what to eat for decades. She is asking this question, what if we've been doing it all wrong, looking to the experts to guide us, and some of them are biased? So what does the data show once you remove the lobbyists, the self-interest, the opinions? Nina Tyshols makes her case. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nina, you've looked at decades, as I mentioned, decades of research, data, political statements, government pronouncements, media stories. What decade, let's pinpoint it, what decade would you pinpoint this in terms of beginning the march down the wrong path as you see it?
The story really starts in the 1950s when the nation was in a panic about the rising tide of heart disease that had been quite rare in the early 1900s and had quickly risen to become the leading cause of death. And President Eisenhower himself had a heart attack in 1955, was out of the Oval Office, and there really was a sense of panic and desperation and urgent need for solutions. And into that vacuum stepped, there were a number of scientists and researchers who had ideas about what was causing heart disease, but there was one researcher named Ansel Keys, who was a pathologist at the University of Minnesota, and his idea that it was saturated fats, the kind that are found in meat, butter, dairy, eggs, cheese, those fats would raise your cholesterol, clog your arteries, and give you a heart attack.
Right. And can I jump in and say, you tell this story so well in your book. During Eisenhower's administration, when he has the heart attack, they have a big press conference. And this Keyes and others in the administration give a big lecture to the American people on heart disease, as well they should, on their view of the steps to take to get out of this situation for all people, not just President Eisenhower. And then everybody starts to follow how he's doing.
He was an extraordinary personality, Ansel Keys. He was able, he had really a kind of outsized ego and an unshakable faith in his own beliefs. He was able to persuade, it wasn't just the American people. I mean, importantly, he persuaded all of his colleagues that he had the solution. And his idea was that if you replace saturated fats with unsaturated fats or polyunsaturated vegetable oils, you know, sunflower, soy, bean oil, all those kinds of oils, that this would keep you from getting atherosclerotic plaques in your arteries. And he was just an incredibly persuasive man. But I don't think that we would have the kind of, I don't think his ideas would have endured as long as they did unless he did one really important thing, which is that in 1961, he was able to get his views implanted into the American Heart Association, which was then the only source of expert guidance in the country and has since risen to become the largest not-for-profit group in the country. And that was in 1961, the very first guidelines to the American public telling them to avoid meat, butter, dairy, eggs, cheese in order to prevent heart disease. And that's like the tiny acorn that grew into an oak tree of official advice, including our USDA dietary guidelines. stemmed from that original piece of nutritional advice in 1961.
You're saying from the research you've done, from the studies you've looked at, interviewing the authors of many of these studies many times, that's not true.
Yes, I mean, it's a stunning story. I mean, I myself was a vegetarian for 25 years and was not prepared for what I discovered at all. And it is so upending of all the conventional wisdom that we've all grown up with and lived with for so many decades. But when that first 1961 recommendation came out, it was really based on very soft science, which is a kind of science that's called observational science. It was a huge study done by Ansel Keys, but it can only ever show an association and not causation. That's like a fundamental flaw and a theme that runs through all of nutrition science is creating recommendations based on this soft science that is then turns out, when properly tested in clinical trials, that can show causation. Turns out that original idea wasn't true. I mean, they did more clinical trials on Ansel Keys' idea, spent more money trying to prove it than any other idea in the history of nutrition science, and they could never prove it to be true. But it became our official dogma, and it became crystallized and institutionalized. And despite a great amount of evidence to the contrary, it's just been impossible to reverse out of his hypothesis.
So Keys, there was this seven-country study.
Right, that was that big original founding study. It's like the Big Bang of nutrition science. All nutrition science telescopes back to this study that Ansel Keys did in seven countries, mainly in Europe, but also in the U.S. and Japan, on 13,000 men, all men. And he took the dietary samples of fewer than 500 of them. And then he linked that dietary data to whether or not they died of cardiovascular disease or had a heart attack. And he discovered that what he'd set out to find, which is that people who ate less saturated fat seemed to also then have lower rates of heart disease. But you know, I took a really deep dive into that study to really understand it because it's been so influential. You know, there were so many methodological difficulties, which, you know, in addition to having a sampling of diet that's too small to be statistically representative, he cherry-picked his countries. In other words, he chose countries like Italy and Spain where they didn't eat much animal foods because they were suffering post-World War II devastation and had low rates of heart disease. And he ignored countries like Germany and Switzerland and France where they also had low rates of heart disease, but they ate a lot of animal foods, you know, the famous omelet-eating French. Mm-hmm. So he didn't select those countries, and that skewed his results. And another example that is kind of emblematic of his oversights, which is that the islanders on the Crete, who were his star subjects, they ate the littlest amount of saturated fats, it seemed, and also seemed to be very long lived. But it turns out in one of the three study periods in which he went to that island, he went during Lent, when they were conscientiously avoiding meat, dairy, eggs, cheese. So I think that you know, that just gives you a sampling of how hard it was to do this kind of research, which has always been a difficult issue in nutrition science, but also the fundamental flaws in this early foundational study that he did.
So, Nina, what happens when people say to you, and we've read this too, that people look freer of certain diseases that we in the United States have in some of these countries, and then as they become more westernized and start some of our food chains and habits bleed to these countries, they start having the diseases that we have, and therefore it's the way we eat?
That's such an excellent question, because when people get wealthier, they do tend to see what is called these chronic diseases, cancer, heart disease, and, you know, all kinds of other problems, obesity now, diabetes. In the 1950s, when Ansel Keys and his colleague looked at this issue, they decided it was the animal foods that people, when they're richer, one of the first things people buy is meat. So they pinpointed the meat as the cause of these diseases. However, when countries become richer, many things change in their diet. And another one of those things is their sugar and refined carb consumption. And in almost every society that they've been able to document where they start to import carbohydrates. You know, those are the foods that travel easily and are easily importable. Sugar, molasses, jam, crackers. Those are the foods that were imported up to the Inuit when their diet, their health was destroyed. And those foods also coincide with growing wealth. So it turns out that those Cretan islanders that I just mentioned who were so long-lived, they did not eat any desserts. There was no record of them eating desserts. I mean, very little, just, on rare occasion. Also in the, the long-lived blue zones or, other populations, the Okinawans, Japanese, who found to be long-lived, they, and people say that's because they eat a vegetarian diet, but they also ate very little sugar.
Mm-hmm. I see. So this is journalist Nina Teicholz, who spent nearly 10 years researching the data on so-called healthy diets. She says we've gotten it wrong, and she tells the story of why in a riveting book. It's absolutely fascinating, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Let me flip this around on you and do the second part of the headline for this show. Why do these things belong in a healthy diet?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One is that over the past decade, there have been a lot of clinical trials, really good, rigorous clinical trials lasting up to 2 years, which is kind of the gold standard for clinical trials, showing that far better than the low-fat diet that we've been prescribed for the last at least 35, 40 years, far better than restricting fat is to restrict carbohydrates for improving health. A low-carbohydrate diet doesn't have to be super low, but you need to add fat. So what you replaced, a higher fat, lower carbohydrate diet is far better for weight loss and also for diabetes, controlling diabetes, and also for various heart disease risk factors. How do you get to a higher fat diet? It's unless you're drinking bowlfuls of vegetable oils or olive oil, fat is found in animal foods. So you need to include those foods if you're going to have a higher fat diet. Again, unless you want to drink a bowlful of vegetable oil.
So the new buzzword in the nutrition and health communities, inflammation. Now we are hearing that inflammation is the root of everything.
Right. Causes inflammation vegetable oils is what we ate in place of saturated fats. Instead of saturated fats, we have unsaturated polyunsaturated vegetable oils. They only came into existence in the early 1900s. Before 1900, Americans cooked only with butter and lard, or mainly with butter and lard. So what are these vegetable oils? We don't know much about them. They've been very little studied. The only thing that researchers focused on is whether or not they raised or lowered cholesterol and pretty much ignored every other biological impact that these oils have on us. It turns out that when they're heated, these vegetable oils, and this is an incredible area of research that I sort of took another deep dive into, but when they're heated, like in in restaurant fryers, mm-hmm. frying operations, they're unstable, they oxidize, they create hundreds of toxic oxidation products, and those produce huge amounts of inflammation, at least in animal models that they've looked at. That issue has received almost no attention in the nutrition world. And another thing that I do in the book is trace the vegetable oil industry influence on nutrition science. So that industry has been, I would argue, perhaps the most powerful industry in steering nutrition science over the last 50 years, including launching the American Heart Association. Procter & Gamble was the key sponsor that launched the American Heart Association in 1948. So that industry knew that they needed to influence industry nutrition science very early on. From the 1940, they founded a foundation and have steered science ever since. So
I met someone from who in PR, woman in PR and in the food industry, and she said to me that her job, she was hired by the olive oil people, and her job was to market olive oil as a health drink.
Well, the olive oil story is its own separate story, and that is That is a chapter in my book, but it's so the olive oil, that was actually a whole campaign that was launched by the European International, consortium to promote olive oil. And they also, but they also knew the way you get people to buy your product is to get nutrition scientists behind it. Mm-hmm. And so they sponsored a series of, you know, what is known as the best ever food conferences in the history of nutrition science all over the Mediterranean, where, of course, anybody would love to go and travel. And they got buy-in, basically, from all these scientists, including, you know, from Harvard and NYU, Marion Nestle. Everybody went to these conferences, and they ended up then recommending olive oil. And, you know, my argument is not that olive oil is bad for health. It's actually a little more stable than, say, soybean oil, corn oil, safflower oil. Those have more double bonds in them and oxidize more than olive oil. It's a little more stable. But olive oil, it turns out you just cannot find the evidence that it's some heart, it has some special heart-saving tonic power to it.
Yeah. Okay, stay where you are. And we're going to come back and talk more about the big fat surprise, why buttermeat and cheese belong in a healthy diet. So stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton, and my guest is Nina Tyscholz, who spent nearly a decade researching the data on so-called healthy diets, the things that the government, you know, food companies, people want to sell books, have been telling us, our own doctors, scientists, what they've all been telling us is responsible for, I don't know, a host of health problems. And she is making the case, after 10 years of looking into these studies, some of them done in a very flimsy way, lots of flaws, others done well, that after looking at that for this decade, she says in the big fat surprise that we got it wrong. And the sentence on the book also is why buttermeat and cheese belong in a healthy diet, meaning, yes, we want fat in the diet. And you said, Nina, I hope I'm paraphrasing this correctly, that higher in protein and lower in carbohydrates is the healthier diet, correct?
Yeah, higher in fat. So it's not a high-protein diet. It's sort of moderate in protein, but it's a higher fat diet, which I know sounds appalling to most people. I mean, we've believed for so long that the fat you eat is the fat you get, what I call the tragic homonym. But it's the higher fat diet that is healthier.
Okay. And why is a larger amount of protein problematic?
Well, if you have too much protein without the accompanying fat, then you are at risk of getting nitrogen poisoning. And, you know, you really need the fat. In fact, you know, in all of the ethnographic records, and if you read anthropologists and colonial doctors, I mean, it turns out that human civilizations seem to have always chosen the fattiest part of the animal. They would eat the organ meats, also very nutritionally dense parts of the animal, but much fattier. And they would leave, like, there's a line about how the Inuit would leave the tenderloin to the dogs, which is hilarious from our point of view. I mean, that's what we've always come to value, lean meat. But lean meat was seen as dry, tasteless, and not really fit for human consumption. Animals that were too lean were not even considered edible.
So we've seen that happen in the pork industry, that marbling of the meat with fat is hard to find unless you're going to a farm where they prize this. And so I'm thinking to myself, from what you've read, are if people add fat to meat that is now so lean, does that do the trick? I mean, healthy fat.
Yes, it makes it healthier. It and it's also delicious. I mean, we've gotten out of that. We've forgotten how delicious, you know, a fattier meat is. I mean, the other thing that people used to do is there was a whole tradition of what was called larding game, where they would take needles and sew strips of bacon onto game meat because bird meat was considered too lean without the added fat from the bacon. You know, and there's another reason that protein and fat are good for you, which is that they, for reasons that researchers don't really know, they're uniquely satiating. They're far more satiating than carbohydrates. So in experiments where researchers have tried to overfeed people and put a stack of pork chops, say, in front of their subjects, people literally cannot overeat on that. They just can't. Whereas, as we all know, it's very easy to overeat on carbohydrate foods, cookies, crackers, chips, bread, even pasta. So fat and protein really fill you up. And also those foods are very nutritionally dense, far more so than most carbohydrates.
I bet there are a number of people who would like to get in on this conversation. Yeah. Some of them professionals probably, and some of them are eaters or dieters or people with heart issues. And so we're going to open the phones, 203-776-WNPR, 203-776-WNPR. WNPR. Journalist Nina Tai-Schultz is my guest, and her book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Buttermeat and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. This idea of protein and fat brings us back to, I'm going to say the name of a man that many people past a certain age will know, Dr. Atkins. You know, maybe some very young listeners will say, who's that? But famous person who was a big hit for dieters for quite a while and then began to be attacked by people in the nutrition and academic worlds, really attacked.
Yeah, he was really reviled in his day. His hit book, The Atkins Diet, came out in the early 1970s, and that was just when the low-fat movement was gaining ascendancy. And he and the nutrition establishment, the expert establishment, really loathed Atkins because, of course, he represented the exact opposite of what they were saying. And he wasn't the first person to have these ideas. I mean, the idea that carbohydrate restriction would work for diabetes and weight loss goes back to the 1870s in England and in France. But there have been various doctors who prescribe it to their patients over the course of the 20th century. But Atkins is the really one, the name we associate with it and who popularized it. So, and he was, one of the interesting things about this whole history is how much it's driven by personality. So he was not a good promoter of his diet in the nutrition world. I mean, he didn't speak their language. He was provocative. He was, difficult and kind of a little bit of a curmudgeon. And also, he didn't have any science to back him up. He would point to his drawerfuls of medical files and say, look, these are my patients and I've cured them, but that's ultimately just anecdotal information. So he didn't have the science. I mean, what happened is that researchers about 15 years ago began looking at the trends in America and seeing, obesity and diabetes skyrocketing despite the fact that Americans were cutting fat, increasing carbohydrates as they'd been told to do, and asking, well, what's gone wrong? And so some of them went back to Atkins and looked through his medical files and said, well, let's do the science. And now that science, those dozens of clinical trials on thousands of people that I mentioned earlier, that science has really been done now. His diet has been tested rigorously in many, many clinical trials.
So as you mentioned in the book, the big rap against him was that he was putting people in a ketosis state and then nutritionists and some health people said that is hurting people's kidneys and you could die or require a new kidney or develop a tumor. Was that true?
No, there were a number of concerns about this diet that puts people in what's called ketosis and which is different. Anyway, I won't go into the details, but they were worried. There are various health concerns about bone density and renal failure. That's why the fact that these trials have lasted 2 years, when you would see these kind of side effects show up, and they didn't, it's basically established the diet is safe. I mean, I don't think too many people say it isn't safe anymore, but. Mm-hmm. But the hostile treatment of Dr. Atkins and his ideas was due to the fact that his advice really flew in the face of the direction that everybody else was going, which is they were going into fat restriction, and he was saying more fat is better, and those were just on a collision course.
So we do have some calls, and so let's get into those. Daniel,
okay.
Faith Middleton with Nina Tai-Schultz, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Daniel. Great. Thanks for being on.
Great. I was wondering if this is a bit of a throwback further than Atkins. the Swedish biologist Carl Linnaeus in the 1700s, promoted a diet that was in hostility to the French diet, he called it, of sweets and carbohydrates, and promoted the Happy Lap diet, the Happy Laplander diet of fatty meats and berries and essentially forage and fish. And he was kind of revolutionary in his hostility to this growing popularity of the continental French diet that was very high in sugars, and he saw that it was leading to a lot of dental decay and, ill health and all kinds of other moral quandaries. I was wondering if you were familiar with his work.
Are you Nina Teicholz?
No, I'm not, but I'm fascinated by that. You said it's back in 1700?
Yeah, it's Carl Linnaeus. He's the founder, essentially, of the Latin identification of plants.
Uh-huh.
And also served as Sweden's kind of health attorney general, whatever they call the, a magister of the health at the time to the king. And,
interesting.
Was promoting this. He would dress up as a Laplander and go to the parties and kind of create this, this persona of himself as like the first kind of diet guru kind of guy who was.
That's totally fascinating. And, because the story the earliest story that I know is of William Banting, who is an undertaker in London who was morbidly obese and tried everything that we try today. He tried restricting calories. He tried, excessive exercise, rowing for hours on end, and couldn't get his weight under control. And then found a doctor who put him on a low-carb diet, a doctor who had sort of deduced that this might work. Based on what they were doing to try to help people to treat diabetes. Mm-hmm. And so Banting, he was like the Atkins of his day in the 1860s, and he sold huge numbers of his dieting. It was called Banting, and he sold he published a pamphlet and sold tens of thousands of copies all over Europe, and he was absolutely famous in his day. He lost, I can't remember how many pounds, maybe 80 pounds restricting carbohydrates. The carbohydrate restriction is, I think of it as like a low-grade fever. It sort of pops up every once in a while. You see a doctor who has a book, and then it goes underground for a little while, and then it pops up again. And there's just been all these sort of episodic doctors who've embraced the low-carb diet, but it didn't really break through until Dr. Atkins came up with it.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Glad you called.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So here's a thing. When the Framingham study came out, it affected so many people. Can you explain what that was quickly, and then its results? And you have trouble with that study.
The Framingham study was a huge epidemiological study that was begun in the 1960s, I believe, to look at what could predict heart disease risk. Right? Was it total cholesterol? Was it your smoking? What was it? How could they understand your risk for heart disease? And when it started out, everybody believed it was total cholesterol that could predict heart disease. That just turned out, that didn't pan out. By the early 1980s, researchers discovered total cholesterol just was not very predictive of heart disease risk. That's when we shifted to LDL and HDL. Framingham was the biggest ever study like that. And ultimately, it ended up undermining this idea that saturated fats cause heart disease. They couldn't find any link between saturated fat consumption and heart disease risk.
In fact, half the people in that study who had heart attacks had cholesterol levels below the normal level of 220.
Right. And
so,
for women,
interesting.
Women, especially a little older women, the higher cholesterol you have, the lower your heart attack risk is. Which is amazing. I mean, it tells you, what woman goes to her doctor and has high cholesterol and her doctor says, hey, great, you're doing really well. Mm-hmm. You just don't hear that. I mean, that's because, that's another part of this story, but that it's been based mainly on data for men. The data on women has not lined up with the data for men for all kinds of reasons, but the particular needs of women and children have really not been addressed.
Okay, this is Nina Teicholz, and her book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Buttermeat and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. She spent 10 years doing a deep dive into all the research that has been out there for decades to see what held up, what didn't, why, what was wrong. Candace Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to say that that's how we eat in my house. Never, nothing low fat comes in the door. And we're both nice and thin, my daughter and I. And it's cheaper. the chicken thighs and the less expensive cuts of meat.
And how do you? What else do you eat in your diet besides
eggs, bacon? From snacks, we'll have cheese sticks.
Okay,
and I grow my own vegetables in the summer, so that helps.
Olive oil,
nothing low fat.
Okay. All right. None of those snack well cookies that are...
No, none of those.
Okay.
My daughter and I can go through a pound of butter in maybe a month.
Wow. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Candace.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take... Nina, stay where you are, please. We're going to take... I can't wait to talk with you about a couple of stories from a couple of friends of mine that you might find challenging. Let's see what happens. We'll take a quick break and we'll come right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. I am talking with Nina Teicholz, who is a contributor to the New Yorker, New York Times, Washington Post, and is author of this book, Took Her 10 Years to Research This, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And one of the things we do on the show, I would imagine this is starting lots of conversations and will for the next days or weeks, maybe months. We like on the show, Nina, to look at diet, food policy from all points of view. And we have done this consistently through the years. And so your turn on the show. Here's a tweet from Stella Rose saying, "Not feeling this at all. Everyone's body has different needs. Meat never worked for me. Much healthier as a vegan." Well, that's an interesting comment about does one size fit all? We keep talking about studies. I know we have to treat large, in a public health model, large numbers of people. But some in the science community say it just doesn't work that way anymore. Everybody's body responds differently. Anyway, she's saying meat has not worked for her. Looking at it as an individual, what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I completely agree that there should not be a one-size-fit-all dietary policy. There's, especially in the United States, with the range of people from different kinds of backgrounds. So I would say a few things. One is that the argument that I would make in terms of policy, if you know, you're talking about the USDA dietary guidelines, is simply to allow for a low-carb option to be one possible treatment. You know, it's still considered a dangerous fad diet. And I think it should be let out of jail. The science clearly supports it, and it really works for some people. So let those people not be told that they'll, it should be one of the range of treatment options for people with obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. I think that the science really supports that. There are people who feel for whom the vegan diet really works well, and I think that all diets work to some extent because they tend to cut out sugar and refined carbohydrates. You go to your doctor, the first thing he says is to give up desserts, and that is a step in the right direction for pretty much 100% of people. The vegan diet is one that is I think can work. It has actually never been tested in clinical trials, so we don't really have any evidence to show that it's healthy, and that is worrisome to me when I just think about that as a policy recommendation, especially when children are having that diet. There's just simply no clinical trial data to show that it's healthy, and there's a number of worrisome signs about its ability to be nutritionally sufficient because plant foods are less dense in nutrients than our animal foods and don't include certain nutrients like vitamin B12. So that's my concern about the vegan diet.
Okay. So here's the challenging stories from two different friends of mine.
Yeah.
Out starts to leak information about this trend back again, away from the low-fat stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now fat is good. And a couple of friends of mine report to me that they, who doesn't want to hear that? And so
right.
they go out and they have serious cholesterol issues.
Right.
One started eating more vegetables and fruit and got off of statins. The other one just was so thrilled with this back to the high fat thing that he went out and he started eating those things he really wants to eat. And both of them had then went into the doctor for their physicals. And the doctors both said in each case, wow, cholesterol high here again. What's going on? And so these two said, you know, I don't think this stuff about butter, eggs, cheese, meat, it didn't work for me. I don't think it's true. I think it, you can see the effects of it in my labs.
Right. The answer I would give to that is that one is that ramping up your fat content has to coincide with lowering your carb consumption. So if you're eating butter, meat, cheese, eggs, but you're also eating desserts, then you will not, it's unlikely that you will really look healthier on that diet. The second thing is that part of this story is a story about what is the best and most predictive heart disease risk factor. So when your doctor says, oh, my total cholesterol is high, that is not a very good predictor of risk. There's a lot of debate now about LDL. There are quite a number of clinical trials showing that your LDL cholesterol is not very predictive of heart attack risk, and that better is HDL, your triglycerides, something called LDL subfractions or LDL particle number, and those all tend to look better when you restrict carbohydrates. But they're relatively... the mindset of most doctors is still back in LDL and total cholesterol. So the complexity of this whole picture means that it's difficult to give a clear answer just for the mm-hmm. information that I have, based on those two people.
Okay. Sandra Faith Middleton with Nina Teicholz. Go ahead.
Hi. I think this is a wonderful informational program that we need to balance, and I think that is the key to all these things. And if you remember watching our old friend Julia Childs, she always gave these little comments of wisdom about it's all in balance. It's in the quantity. It's using common sense. Reflect what your body tells you. If you're getting heartburn from something you're eating, don't eat it.
Uh-huh.
So, I think the Bible has a lot of common sense on this. He says, give your child an egg. I don't think God did that or created chickens to have eggs if we weren't supposed to eat them. It doesn't say give them the white of the egg. So, but I think common sense, if you listen to your body and try to eat possibly even what your heritage is, different people do have different chemicals working in their bodies, whether it's alcohol or beef. It might be, whether you're German or English like I am, unfortunately, you can't tolerate much of this good stuff. You only need very little food. We're supposed to be thin. And let your body be the doctor.
Well, Julia Child used to come on the show quite often when she was alive, and I knew every time the one sentence that I could say to her that would inflame the show and make it really interesting, and it was always some version of, what about these stories we're seeing now that butter is not good for you? And she would just take off, that we'd be off and running.
Well, just look at her, and the proof is in the life. She was a healthy person to a very nice age and enjoyed life and food and did it in a way that everybody was able to go along with her and benefit from it. Just like Wolfgang Puck and all these other people, they say they got the dessert, but that's all they had for supper. They had one piece of this real rich, a small piece of some real rich dessert, and that was their supper. We didn't have it after a meal.
Having said all this, I'm thinking of a chef that I know who has had heart trouble, and so when you think your life is in the balance, I would say, careful. You can hear this show, but have somebody as your guide. if you're going to try changes, and watch out, you know, because when you're in the middle of heart disease, it's not funny. It's pretty scary.
That's absolutely
true. My dad died at 50 and my brother at 40. So I have been on that list of, you know, if I had anything go wrong, they would put me on the machines and the diets and everything. Well, I'm now 77 and perfectly healthy, not taking any medication, eating eggs and what I feel like is good for me, wholesome food like you lived on the farm, and the work that goes along with it. That's another thing. Farm people are usually healthy because not only, you know, do they eat well, but they get a lot of exercise.
Yeah. Thank you, Sandra, as always.
Thank
I'm glad you.
You
called. Okay. Bye-bye.
So,
Nina, what did you, I could hear you agreeing with, you know, if you're going to change your diet, have some help.
Oh, absolutely, have some help, and I think it's, you know, because there's so much individual response, you know, which is another point about government policy telling people basically how to treat their illnesses. You know, if you are obese and have diabetic or heart disease or have heart disease, you know, that's a condition that you want to have your doctor advise you on, and you don't want some one size fits all national dietary policy. I also really agree with the point about balance in diet. And, you know, one of the things that's happened since we started having our dietary guidelines, you know, that's the food pyramid and now my plate, but is that they told that big bottom slab of the food pyramid is all carbohydrates, you know, pasta, grains, potatoes. And so Americans really complied with that. And the big shift is that we went from eating about 40% of our calories as carbohydrates to more than 50%, and we've decreased fat. So we're out of balance, and we one of the things I think is that we basically have a high carbohydrate diet now, and returning to a more balanced diet, backing out of the high carb diet, which is what we ate before the obesity and diabetes epidemics, would probably be a step in the good in the right direction.
So, knowing what you know, Nina, do you still sit down to a good bowl of delicious pasta from time to time at your favorite Italian restaurant?
You know, I have to say no. I eat vegetables. I eat fruit. You know, if I drink carbohydrates as wine. I do occasionally. I love chocolate, but I don't have much bread or pasta.
Okay, that's where you bargain. That's where you that's your plan. I understand.
I guess so. You know, one of the ways I think about it is, you know, is I eat my fat and protein, and then if I'm still hungry, I have some carbs. But I don't think of them as the centerpiece of my meal.
Okay. And that's so different from the food pyramids from the government that we have received all these years, as you say. What about this new pyramid? I shouldn't call it a pyramid. I should call it a plate, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it's increasingly vague, I think, as a graphic. This new one, the new committee report that just came out, it's good in some ways. It puts a cap on sugar for the first time. That seems long overdue, and it backs off the caps on dietary cholesterol. That's why we haven't been eating egg yolks or liver or shrimp, you know, that because of the cholesterol in them. It turns out your body can regulate its own cholesterol. If you eat a lot, it just down-regulates its own production. But that backing off cholesterol is the cholesterol hypothesis was part of the same one that said that fat was bad for you. So it's like they've backed out of half of it, and the other half has similarly weak science behind it. But it's a lot harder to back out of the low-fat diet, and they still recommend the low-fat diet, low in saturated fat, you know, reduced meat, low-fat dairy, all of that, I think, is still really hugely problematic and not based on good science.
Let's come back to the Atkins plan for a minute. High protein, low carbs.
High fat.
Sorry, high fat. Well, yes, high fat, I'm sorry. Which usually means high protein. You know?
Meat, moderate protein, higher fat.
Yeah.
Like, but instead of lean meat, regular meat.
So in the book, you talk in one place about how diet soda, well, actually, our nutrition guy on the show the other day, I think he did this. He was saying, you know, diet soda, the body's reading that as sugar, even though it's not sugar. And
to
so
some
you're
extent, yep.
You're still addicted to sugar.
Right.
And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Atkins, who believed in this philosophy, put out those Atkins bars, which were filled with sugar substitute stuff. And so all those people who thought they were getting off sugar were probably still addicted to sugar from eating those bars. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's highly processed food, too, with a lot of other stuff in it that, you know, whey protein or soy protein. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I think one of the things that we've seen in recent years is this an attempt to eat foods that are more real foods, less processed foods. And I think that's a helpful message, but it's not a message that is not so helpful in the sense that, you know, cheese is highly processed food, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think you can be both vegan and you can be on the Atkins diet and both say you're eating real foods, but those are radically different diets. So it's helpful, but maybe not sufficient as a guideline.
So interesting. This is Nina Teicholz, Teicholz. Information about her book is at our website, The Faith Middleton Show, WNPR.org. Her book is called The Big Fat Surprise. It is fascinating. Subhead, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Yoli, welcome to the show. Oh, I'm sorry, we lost Yoli. Apologies. Lynn, it's your turn. Welcome to the show. Lynn, you there?
Lynn, yes.
Yes, hi. Yes, hi.
Faith?
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
In 2012, I was about to retire. I was 280 pounds. I had hit the triple crown of the cholesterol was out of this world. Mm-hmm. I had diabetes. And my A1C came in at 9.1, and I had high blood pressure. So I said to myself, I have to do something. And what has always worked for me in the past was giving up carbs, and I did it sporadically throughout my life. And then I got serious about it, and I gave up a lot of carbs, and I don't think we ever give up carbs completely, but because they come, they're in everything that we eat, and you know, a baked potato might have a certain number of carbs, especially things like that.
Yeah.
But I focused on good quality meat, and that included fats. And I focused on not eating pasta, not eating bread. I ate butter, and I still do today. In 6 months, I lost 90 pounds.
Wow.
My A1C went to 5.9 at its lowest. My cholesterol was totally within the normal levels. And I was off of metformin. I'm off of I still take 5 milligrams of Benicar for the high blood pressure. But that's totally in control. And I'm off of everything. I've never been able to take statins. Mm-hmm. And that was scary for me because I couldn't take anything
side
to
effects.
Help me with you know, that. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to retire, and within 2 years, I'm going to have a heart attack and die.
Yeah, Lynn, I'm so happy for you.
Yeah.
I'm glad that worked. And do you enjoy your meals?
Oh, my God, I love it. I mean, I slipped for a while, gained back some weight. I'm losing it back again. Mm-hmm. But fruit becomes so sweet when you give up sugar.
I know it. Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much, Lynn, and good luck to you.
You're welcome.
Happy
thank
retirement.
You, I love your show.
Thank you
thank
so
you,
much.
Thank you, Nina, for the study. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Nina, as you go around the country, what I'm interested in is what kind of pushback are you getting from the establishment?
Well, you know, the establishment is now very aligned behind this idea that we should be eating
30 seconds, sorry.
Mostly plants. And you know, they're not really hospitable to these ideas because they're so diametrically opposed to what they're saying. But, you know, there's some common ground. I mean, this the understanding that vegetable oils are not healthy, they should not be a main source of fat. So there are a few areas, I think, of common ground.
That's a good way to put it. Thank you. I think that you've honed that well over there as the arrows come in your direction.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nina. Really fascinating book, The Big Fat Surprise. I'm Faith Middleton, and this show, as always, is about the richness of life. And you can find the books, especially this one, People, Recipes, everything we've got online right now at the Faith Middleton Show, WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.